Now, what is there beyond the edge of the solar system? And the title of this talk is Pluto and Beyond. Well, to be honest with you, there's not terribly much. Here's a sort of a perspective view again of the planetary orbits. And you can see I've brought little Pluto a bit closer in this picture. Although many of you are sitting about 30 feet from this screen, it won't, well, it would help if you did move up here, but Pluto in actual fact is a huge distance from us. And there's no way in the world we'd see it tonight because it is extremely cloudy and there are meteorological difficulties that would make... Nonetheless, I have seen Pluto. I was lucky enough to visit the Lowell Observatory in Arizona a couple of years ago, and where Percival he'd built that telescope, and it was Clyde Tombaugh, about 1930 or thereabouts. He was the one who discovered Pluto with that telescope, and it turns out that it is an extremely faint object. And since those 30 years, and bearing in mind Clyde's telescope, you know, by modern standards was very primitive, really no other objects have been discovered until very recently, and then Pluto orbits on average at about 30 astronomical units. Since that time, there have been found to be some very, very small objects beyond the orbit of Pluto, about 13 of these little bodies. They're very dark. And they're probably only a few hundred kilometres at most across, probably even less than 100 kilometres. And there's speculation, perhaps, you know, there are other planets out there. But the combined mass of all these objects is extremely small, and even much less than the mass of Pluto. Pluto's radius is about, diameter is about 2,300 kilometres. And I believe that these extra objects that have now been discovered at about between 35 and 40 astronomical units are in fact remnant planetesimals that were on Neptune's orbit and which were sort of expelled through repeated passages and coming close to Neptune. Somehow Pluto has managed to become stranded into a resonant orbit and it'll always remain there, but these other objects have just through collisional erosion have actually, the ones that remain are just sort of lurking out there at about 35 astronomical units. They've obviously achieved some sort of truce with Neptune that they promise they won't go near it, and in return Neptune will allow them to persist for a few more eons. But actually the mass of those materials is just minuscule compared to the mass of Pluto, which in turn is only less than a 600th of the mass of the Earth. And one of the things that did sort of emerge from this Flagstaff meeting that I was talking to about a moment ago, where Pluto was discovered, is just how sharp the boundary is at the edge of the solar system. Pretty well, once you've crossed the orbit of Neptune, that's really the end of the line. Recently, Mr. Kennett, our Liberal leader, extended the Dandenong line out to Cranbourne. He possibly was under the impression that this was going out to a new planetary distance. But in fact, I tried the train that very first morning and I waited an hour for it to show up, and then it headed off to Frankston due to some incredible stuff up. You better delete that one, Andrew, if this is going to air. the astute observer, and I'm sure David is here, falls into that category, will notice a rubble pile in the middle. That, of course, is the asteroidal belt. Anyway, what I'm trying to drive at, the solar system is quite a unique object. It doesn't sort of just gradually taper off into interstellar space. There really is a very sharp boundary. And I think Neptune was, in fact, the first formed planet, and that was where the first of these gas rings was actually cast off. Now, these clouds fall from the interstellar medium and through a process of convection become a rigidly rotating structure, and then as they contract they gradually speed up, and this is the Laplace's model. The stage is reached where the centrifugal force overcomes the gravitational force, and you get a unique position where this happens, a well-defined position, and a ring of gas is left behind, and then the cloud continues to contract and other rings are shed as well. Now, that's the gas ring model. With the disk model, there's a great sort of sluffy sort of disk that tapers way out beyond the Oort cloud, and you'd expect a continuous gradation of planets, and that this is certainly not borne out by the data. So Pluto, I think, is a remnant object that formed on Neptune's orbit and eventually was pumped, had a close collision with Neptune and eventually got stranded out here. I believe the mass of the Sun, if anyone's taking notes in the beginning, it was something like 20% larger than it is today. The Sun roughly lost about 20% of its mass during the process of contraction from the interstellar medium. And when people look at Pluto's orbit today and say, well, there's no way, you know, Pluto could ever have come any closer than it is or could have ever been on Neptune's orbit, these calculations that are done are always, they just take the present mass of the Sun. But I think Pluto got locked into its current orbit right on in the beginning when the Sun was very much more massive than it is today, and there was a lot of stuff thrown off which was then lost through winds. And so the calculation, I think, is a bit more complicated, and Pluto was actually left sort of stranded, a bit like a whale can get stranded on a beach or a high tide. If you go walking along the beach, you'll find objects strewn up at the high tide mark or even a super high tide, and you wonder how they got there. Well, I think Pluto was left by the Sun when it was more massive, and there's no way, you know, Pluto now is stranded in a sort of a resonant position, and it can never change because the Sun's mass is now locked into its present value. It's losing very little mass at the moment. That's probably the best picture we have of Pluto, at least near to the best, not the best. Colin Norman would have had the best one. Colin always used to brag. I met him in Oxford, and he claimed to be able to drink more than anyone else, but we often did quite a bit of punting, and he would always tell of all his sort of drinking exploits and ability to squaff huge quantities of alcohol in the shortest possible time. And that one also should be deleted. But the thing is, Colin has done a marvellous job over there at the Space Telescope Institute. Now, this one you can include. He has, in fact, managed this, and now they've got even much better images. This is before they did a complete fix on it. And you can see, but even the best telescope images are still pretty raw. And it won't be till we really have a real Pluto flyby, or as Mark has kindly informed, he's found out on the internet, it's called the Pluto Express, which will take off later this decade, about 1998, I think Kate's best estimate. Then we'll really see the planet as is. These are just a montage. It's a sort of double moon system or double planet system. You've got Pluto and its companion Charon. They go around, take about a week to go around or complete an orbit. They rotate around their common centre of mass. Pluto is about something like 8 or 9 times heavier than Charon, and so it, the centre of mass is nearer that body. And the wobble that's seen of Pluto around its relative to that, what's called the centre of mass, that's the thing that the Hubble is able to measure and thereby deduce the density of these bodies. But as far as getting a nice sort of gleaming picture of the body, we'll just have to wait, and this can only be a guess. My suspicion would be that Pluto will in fact, it'll be made of lots of dry ice on it and carbon. That's my prediction, that this moon was formed in the same orbit of Neptune. It'd be very rich in carbon, and also its companion. But as far as it's unlikely that it'll be there, you'll find the Disney character out there as well. But we really do need a spacecraft to show that one. So there's this very, very, very sharp boundary at the edge of the solar system, and it's almost like sailing across an ocean and you're coming to a tropical island, and then you go ashore on the island and you've inspect all the trees that are there and the animal life and birds and so on, and it's all quite a unique little habitat. And our solar system is just like that. I think it was all sort of hatched by the Sun, and a lot of well-defined processes occurred back... I'm going to strangle myself with this device here, Andrew Rennie. I'll put it in there. you really, you know, this process of star formation, I think, is one that it's going to throw a lot of light on whether, if we can just understand our own solar system and how it formed, and if we discover these common processes, I think we'll almost certainly find that this process was repeated elsewhere. And the claim made by Zuckerman the other day that solar systems are quite rare because he's unable to observe gas after 10 million years, he concludes that, you know, we're quite unique, and we have to go now back to the pre-Copernican days where the sun, you know, the Earth went around, at least the Earth was the centre, sort of a geocentric model. I think that's the wrong way to go. What those guys haven't faced up to, and it must be very difficult for them to do that, is that their models upon which they draw these inferences, their erroneous inferences, they must come to the conclusion that their models are erroneous themselves, but they're very reluctant to do that. And it needs someone like myself, in fact, to draw that fact to the general attention of the public.